Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Eric Stroh, and he'll be answering your most important questions on common sense fly fishing. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Eric a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Eric about common sense fly fishing. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Eric, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Eric's section that says click here to register for the drawing. Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Eric's latest book, Common Sense Fly Fishing, courtesy of Headwater Books. And you'll love to have this book, especially after we do this show tonight, I'm sure, because it's just chock full of nothing but good practical tips and techniques and strategies that I'm sure you'll catch more fish by reading just this one book. So pay attention. We're going to be asking a question at the end of the show based upon something that we talked about during the show. And the first person to answer that question at the end of the show will win the Eric's book, Common Sense Fly Fishing. So you have to have the correct answer and put in your name along with your location in the text box on our homepage and submit that when we ask the question, and then we'll see who the winner is. Tonight our guest is Eric Stroh. Eric is the founder, owner, and operator of the Spruce Creek Fly Company. Eric has solidified his reputation as one of the premier guides in the East. Years of repeat customers are testimony to his ever-evolving techniques and skill. His dedication to the great sport of fly fishing is confirmed each year by the average 100 guided days in central Pennsylvania and southwest Montana. Eric's knowledge and passion extends well beyond guiding. As the official instructor of the Regal Engineering Fly Tying School in Pennsylvania, Eric has the opportunity to share his knowledge of fly tying and entomology that enhances any eastern fly fishing experience. His fly tying techniques are also available on his DVD, Practical Fly Patterns That Catch Trout, Volume 1 and 2, with fly fishing great Charlie Meck. In addition, he is a clinic instructor for the USA Youth Fly Fishing Team, an accomplished writer. Eric had feature articles in Fly Fisherman magazine, Eastern Fly Fishing, and is a regular contributor to the Mid-Atlantic Fly Fishing Guide. He has also been recently named the managing editor of Kite Magazine. The release of his recent book, Common Sense Fly Fishing, Seven Simple Lessons to Catch More Trout, has allowed Eric to educate the masses on the principles he teaches on the water every day. Well, Eric, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I think we're going to have a lot of fun tonight because I've been reading your book, and like I said, it's just got nothing but good practical information in it, and I've learned a few things, and I'm sure you're going to share some of those things tonight and teach folks a bit more about how to catch more trout.
Well, thank you. Tried to just put a guided day into print form with the book, so hopefully it does help people.
Yeah, I think all of us that have been out with guides end up having learned a lot by the end of the day, especially, you know, on new water, and every guide has his own way of doing things, and there can be, you know, 15 different ways to do one thing, and they all work.
Right.
So there's always something to learn. Well, we've got some great questions to start out with from Gil Hansen in Merced, California. And he asks, we'll talk about guides and guiding here first. He says, what is the ultimate purpose of a guide? Client catching fish, improve technique, share those secret spots. So what do you think your purpose as a guide is?
Well, I think, Roger, it's all of those things. I think you would hire a guide for all of those reasons. I know that any time that I go to a new water that I've never fished before, I try to hire a guide. It takes a lot off of the learning curve. And obviously, people that are new to the sport, you know, it's real nice to start fly fishing and start doing it in a way that doesn't develop a lot of bad habits. And, you know, as you said, all guides, you know, there's 100 ways to skin a cat, and you can learn something from all different types of techniques and different guides. So I think, you know, the ultimate purpose of a guide is all of those reasons.
Okay. He has a second question, and he says, on guiding, we often hear about guides who get bad clients, rude, arrogant, mean, etc. But what about the client who gets a bad guide? Obviously, no tip sends a message, but this scenario could still be a $500 or more mistake.
Yeah,
any thoughts? And I guess he's asking, any thoughts on how to get a good guide?
Well, yeah, and I'll address the first one, the first part of that question first. I can tell you in 10 years or so of doing this, I've probably got less than a handful of clients that I wouldn't want to take out again. So I don't think that happens too much. I always tell people, you know, even guys that are probably not the friendliest guys in real life, when they come fishing and they're on a trout stream, they're in a pretty good mood. So I don't have many arrogant stories to tell about that. But, you know, a bad guide, guides are just like any other profession. You can get a bad accountant or a bad attorney or, you know, use a bad bank. I suggest that people, if you're going to go out with a fishing guide, I suggest that you talk to that guide in person, you know, either via the phone or something, because you can tell a lot just from a conversation with somebody. And, you know, certainly there are some people who their personalities don't mix well, and you can tell within 5 minutes of a conversation if that's going to be the case. So I would suggest, you know, if you're going to spend a lot of money with a guide, make sure that you talk to them first and you let them know what your expectations are for the day. You know, we talked about what's the purpose of a guide. If your purpose for going and using an outfitter for a specific reason is to improve your technique or to learn the water, make sure that your guide knows that. And if it's anybody that's worth their salt, they're going to do everything they can to make sure you have a great trip.
Yeah, and I suppose if you have a partner coming with you, like a spouse or something, or a child that needs extra help and learning some things new to the sport, that you should let, you know, find out if the guide is ready for that.
Absolutely. And he may say, you know what, this is not my specialty. I'm going to put you with somebody else or recommend somebody else. You know, nobody wants to spend a bad day on the water. So that includes the guides.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, let the guide know what your expectations are and, you know, by all means, make sure that you speak with them.
Right. Okay, we're going to get into a lot of good detail tonight on tips and techniques and so forth. But to start this thing out, we've got a question from Tony Loader in Sydney, Australia. And he asks, what is the most common error you see from your clients that prevents them from catching more fish, and how do you approach curing that error?
That's the million-dollar question. I would say, you know, every client is different. And what really separates the good guides from the, say, inexperienced guides are being able to identify the problem early and correct it, or, you know, or at least move in the right direction to correct it. You know, if I had to pick one error, I would say it's they don't recognize a good drift. And, you know, we see that a lot in central Pennsylvania. I really believe it's one of the tougher places to catch trout in the country, because our fish literally 12 months out of the year and you've always, almost always got to match something. And if you don't get a good drift, that could be really critical to your success. And I would say, you know, if I had to pick one thing, I would say that they don't recognize the good drift. Now, what causes that is completely different with every person. Every individual is different, but I would say that that's the most common error.
Okay. Let's talk about drift then. You, and we've got several topics here that I'm going to ask you about tonight that are in your book,
okay.
Lessons that you teach there. So I know we can't cover your whole book here in 90 minutes, but, you know, I'll ask you to share a few things, you know, and these
sure.
lessons that might help people out there. So let's, drift was the first thing you started out with. That's very important to you, it seems. In your book, you really make that an important item, and you just said that's one of the major places where people can make mistakes. So can you just talk to us about drift and your philosophy behind getting a good one?
Sure. I mean, and I started with it for a reason. You can have the most expensive gear, the best flies. All of that means absolutely nothing if you can't get a good drift. You're not going to catch many trout. And, of course, there are times when, you know, moving a fly will entice a strike. But, you know, 90% of the time the trout want the fly or flies moving in a natural manner that we call a dead drift. And it's one of the hardest things to achieve, especially for people that are new to the sport of fly fishing. And it's hard to even recognize. So I started with that because it should really, drift should determine everything that you do from the beginning till you're done. It should determine how you approach the stream. It should determine how you cast. You know, when you think about how you're going to approach a fish and put a cast on a fish, you have to take into consideration what the current is doing and maybe how many different speeds of current you're fishing over. So you want to put yourself in the right position so that it will allow a good drift. So I think, you know, of all the things that we do, and even the rest of the book, if you did all of the things in the book but you couldn't get a drift, it wouldn't do you any good. It's that important.
Now, so to get a good drift, what are we looking for in the stream? And what are we watching for or watching out for or trying to avoid?
Well, I mean, I think first thing you have to take into consideration is when you think about drift, it's really we're using the current to deliver our flies to the fish. You know, I tell the story in my presentations. I one time had gotten into a stream. We have a small piece of Spruce Creek here that we lease, and we always approach it on our knees. And I was always curious what the fish could see. So one August, I got in there with some goggles on, and I wanted to see what I could see on the bank from the stream. And as I got in the water, I couldn't believe the amount of debris and, you know, pieces of sticks and grass and bugs, everything that was moving in the current at one speed. And it was really an eye-opener for me because I realized, wow, you know, now I can see it. When our flies aren't moving at the same speed as everything else in the water, it's blaringly obvious. So I think, you know, when you think about drift, you really have to consider that we're using the current to deliver the flies. The trout, they're not like bass where they go out looking for food for the most part. They're going to get into a current lie, and they're going to allow the current to bring food to them, and we have to be able to use that current properly to do that. And, you know, if we get drag on our flies, it's going to pull our flies faster or perpendicular to the current. So it's really important to understand the current speed that you're fishing, the currents that you have to fish through to that current speed. At any one time, you might be fishing through more than one current speed, and you're going to have to make adjustments on your fly line to alleviate the pressure on the flies. But I think the recognition of the different speeds of water is the first step, and the second step is being able to do something with your fly line to accomplish what we're talking about.
Yeah, I know we're going to talk about that more later on with casting and, mm-hmm. and line control and so forth. But you did make a, I think, a very good point in your book about your location. And you talked about getting as close as possible.
Right.
And can you kind of talk about that?
Yes. I mean, one of the things I talk about are primary and secondary currents, which I just touched on briefly. You know, we'll say that the fish is in, we'll just say for argument's sake, right in the middle of the stream, and that's the fastest current. Now, unless we can stand directly in that current to fish to that fish, we're going to have to stand in a location where we'll have to fish through some slower water. And the point of understanding the two different current speeds there is being able to get yourself into a position to where the slower current speed's not going to affect the drift on your primary current that you're fishing. So, you know, if the closer you can get to the fish, the more different current speeds that you can eliminate. And in many situations, especially faster water, you can get pretty close to fish. And, you know, we always recommend that people fish upstream, come approach the fish from behind, because that allows you to get a little closer.
And not be seen as easily.
And not be seen, correctly.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, that's easier said than done in many locations, because there's a lot of prime spots we see, and we go, oh, gosh, you know.
Right.
We know there's a fish there.
Right.
Yet there's four currents between you and that fish.
Exactly.
It's a little tough to get to some of those areas.
Right.
So, talk about reading water, and I know you've got some different takes on that. Tony and Cook in Grand Rapids, Michigan ask, first of all, is it better to fish clear water or slightly stained water?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think there's a lot of variables that would come into that to be able to just give a blanket yes or no to that. Things like temperature and is the water getting cloudy or is it getting clear? Sometimes either one can turn the fish on. I've always enjoyed when the water's a little bit stained just because you can get closer to the fish quite often.
Okay.
You know, and everybody knows what it's like to fish in July when the water's crystal clear.
Right.
And you've got to cast 60 feet instead of, you know, getting closer and casting 30 feet.
And the, so, I guess the same thing kind of comes true, you know, when you get towards the evening hours, you
right.
gain a little protection from the darkness.
Exactly.
As well. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the whole game is just trying to hide yourself so that and get
right.
closer.
Yeah, I think people forget sometimes that, you know, we're hunting and we're stalking.
Yeah.
We have an ex-fish commissioner here he's well into his 90s now, but his name's Rosie Stead. He's a dear friend of mine, and he always told me we need to teach people to stalk fish, not stalk fish. So,
yeah.
Yeah, and he's right. He's very
yeah.
right. Lee Wolf had an interesting quote as well, and I know I can't say it verbatim, but it was basically that trout have a window of tolerable intrusion, and they'll allow you into a certain area and still feed, but know you're there. And Lee Wolf said, it's been my experience that most anglers really push that window. So you don't want to get too close to them,
right?
But you've got to get as close as you can.
Well, we need to take a quick break here, Eric, and we'll be right back. And I want to talk to you about the different lies and how they play a role in where you fish. So be ready for that.
Great.
We'll be right back. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas South Platte and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Eric Straup about common sense fly fishing. If you'd like to ask Eric a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Eric, before we jump back in and talk about the lies of the fish, tell us just a little bit about what's happening in your fly fishing world, about your business and other things you might be doing.
Well, in our neck of the woods, my wife Tracy and I, we run a guiding outfit. And one thing that we've got coming up, which I think could be of some interest to your listeners, is we're running a sulfur school, which is going to be on May 24th, 25th, and 26th. And in this school, we're going to be tying sulfurs. We're going to hear lectures on the bugs and obviously fishing the hatch. It will be guided fishing. We've got lectures from Greg Hoover, who is one of the leading entomologists in the world. Tom Baltz is going to be a part of this, who's one of the best fly tiers in the country. And it's going to be a lot of fun. The price is $9.95 per angler. and it's all inclusive. It's lodging, guided fishing, tying materials, and meals. So that's what's new on the horizon for us. I'm really excited about it. I've wanted to do this for a number of years, and finally got the courage to just block the days off the calendar.
Well, that certainly sounds like something different.
Yes.
Focusing on a bug and the fishing around that bug. So sounds exciting.
Yes.
And what's your website if people want to learn more about your classes and your guide services? Where would they find you?
The website is www.sprucecreekflyco.com, and all our contact information is on there. We've got a blog, and we're also on Facebook, so feel free to jump on and contact us. And certainly if you're coming to central Pennsylvania to fish, give us a call, and we'll update you as far as bug activity and what's fishing well.
Okay, great. Well, let's talk about those lies for the fish. Again, in your book you mentioned, and this is where I really learned something about the different lies. I knew where fish would hold, but I didn't realize the difference between those holding areas and their activity. So could you kind of break down those different lies that you talk about and why they're important and how we should fish them?
Yeah, I talk about feeding lies and prime lies and sheltering lies. And obviously you can find the fish in all of those. I don't know exactly what your question is, Roger, but I can expand a little on each of those.
Yeah, if you would, please. It's like each one of those lies you had mentioned, that the fish are there for a reason and not necessarily sometimes to eat, I found out.
Yeah, correct. A sheltering lie, obviously, is a lie where a fish would go, it might be under a log, that they feel safe. And then, of course, you've got feeding lies. And these are the areas that a lot of anglers walk right past. In fact, I had a really interesting experience the other night with a client. We were fishing a Hendrickson spinnerfall, and the client was not really able to get the drift that we talk about, which is so important, in a flat pool where the fish were rising. So I walked downstream a little ways into a very shallow riffle, and I'm going to say the riffle was probably less than a foot deep for a good 100 yards, and there were fish stacked in there eating spinners. And we were catching fish right at our feet, one after the other. It was absolutely amazing, and that's a great example of a feeding lie. It's just a place where the trout will go when the conditions are right, when there's a lot of feed in the water, and they're there just to eat. And it's not a place where they're going to stay for a very long time, but when there's food in the water and they need to get some nourishment, that's where they're going to be. I also talk about prime lies. Prime lies are areas that offer both. They offer shelter and a feeding lie. It might be a place at the leading edge of a rock, in a good current. There's a hydraulic cushion that'll be in front of any structure, and that fish can sit right in there and pick off food that's coming in the current. So I think those are the three major lies, and occasionally I find prime lies in places that I would never expect it. And once you do find one of those areas, always look there, because there will always be a fish there, unless it changes somehow in a storm.
You had, I'm trying to find it in your book here, but you had a diagram of the different lies, and it seems that you've got the tail of a pool or a run and the head of a pool.
Right.
You talk about both of those as being good feeding lies. Now, that may or may not be a prime lie, right?
That's correct.
So those are areas they could move into, feed, and then move back out into a sheltering lie.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, a lot of the feeding lies are typically waters where the fish is fairly exposed. And they're there just for the simple fact that there's a good current line that's funneling a lot of food. If there's nymphs that are emerging, a good strong current that's funneled into an area may be the perfect place for a trout to go and feed. But it's not a prime lie, because the fish is not going to stay there after he eats.
Okay.
It's not a place where he'd be comfortable.
So a great prime lie would be potentially an undercut bank or log with the current coming right next to it.
Absolutely.
Where a fish could just kind of poke out, grab something, tuck back in.
Absolutely. And those are the kind of places where, those are the holes that most guys fish. They see a deep little slot somewhere, and I know guys that they'll go prime lie to prime lie, and they won't fish anything else. But,
right.
You know, those are places that always, always hold fish.
Okay. Yeah, I found it real interesting, and I think I've mentioned this on prior shows, but we were interviewing some fly fishers at the fly fishing competition in Colorado here a few years ago. And in between interviews, we were standing on a bridge over the South Platte, just looking down in the water, and we could see several trout there. And it was very interesting to watch them from above because they weren't threatened, and just to watch how they were feeding. And they were behind a rock with two rocks. A couple of them were behind a rock. And the current was going between the rocks, just a nice, smooth current. And they would just move out into the current, grab something, go back in. Move out,
right.
Grab something, go back in. And it was just very interesting to watch them and how methodical they are, you know,
right.
Their feeding activity. So I think once you learn how they're doing it, then you can better fish to them as well, you know. So
yes, they're economists of motion. You know, the least amount of energy they can expend and yet still feed, that's what they're going to do.
Well, another area you talk about is the approach and how to approach these lies. And we had a question from Greg in Wisconsin, which is a real basic question, but we all kind of blow this, I think, many times. He says, what determines when to be on shore or on the water? And I think what he's talking about is the approach, you know.
Right.
And so many of us just march right into the water because that's what we think we're going to do, get the best approach. But talk to us a bit about your approach and how we should approach these lies.
Well, you know, one thing I like to begin with is, you know, I never walk into a place that I don't fish first. And it's quite often, especially early in the season, we saw this last week in our guidings, the fish were not in the main currents. We had a little bit of high water and a little more water than the river normally has. And quite often, the fish were right where we typically stand. So we always fish our way out into the water. I would say, you know, in small streams, and I'm talking streams that are 30 feet wide or less, you certainly, if you can do it without getting into the water, you're going to be much better off. But again, drift should be your major consideration. If you can achieve a drift without getting in, I think you're much better off typically than getting into the water. You know, once we step in there, they know we're there. So it just makes the game a little tougher.
When you, let's say, and like I'm looking at this diagram in your book of where you've identified the lies. So let's say we have a riffle, the head of a runner pool. We go through the pool, and then we have the tail of the pool and into another riffle. Okay, looking at a piece of water like that, how would you approach that to fish it?
Well, I almost always fish upstream. You know, and I would start at the tail end, and I'd work my way up into the water. And if I don't have to be in the stream, I certainly wouldn't be. You know, if I can achieve a drift without getting in, I think that's the ultimate. You know, if they don't know we're there, we're much better off. But I like to work my way upstream, you know, because obviously if you catch a fish out in front of a bunch of other fish, you can really put a pull down. So always work upstream.
Okay. So you'll fish that tail end of the runner pool first.
Right.
And then work your way up through the different lies to the head of the pool.
Right.
Is there a particular, I know we're looking for the currents, you know, and how we're going to get that drift. When you say upstream, we've got about 45 degrees to work with there, don't we? From directly below the fish to, you know, say...
You're referring to the bend pole that's in the book? Is that what you're...
Actually, just any approach. What I'm looking for is the angle of approach. You know, what's our best angle? You say upstream, but, you know,
can
it be 45 degrees or 10 degrees off? Or, you know, does that make a difference?
Well, I think it depends on the currents. If, you know, you don't want to line fish, and, you know, I always fish the edges first, and, you know, in order to get a drift, you know, and it depends on if you're nymphing or dry fly fishing, but you want to be able to get a good drag-free drift to the areas that you identify as areas that are holding fish. So, you know, you don't want to stand in a place where your fly line's going to get swept away. You know, I talk about in the book a corridor between the rod tip and the fly, or the oar indicator, either one. But that area, if you can make that corridor parallel to the current, you have a better chance of getting a good drift. So if the fly and the rod tip can be parallel to the current that you're fishing, then you're in the right position. Does that make sense?
Sure, because you're not contending intermediate currents, right?
Exactly. So you want your physical position to be in a place where you can achieve that.
Okay. Okay. Now, you also talk about casting, and a few essential casts you talk about that you think everybody should be able to do to get the best effect delivering the fly and the currents in place.
Right.
You want to talk about those casts? And
Sure. I think there's three really essential casts that you need to be able to do at any one time, and that one is the tuck cast. If anybody nymphs, I'm a nympher by heart. I love to nymph fish. Joe Humphreys and George Harvey from our area here, and those guys made a living out of the tuck cast, and that's an essential cast for anybody that's going to fish on the bottom. It's really nothing more than a powerful cast that has a high stop, and it delivers the flies into the current vertically, rather than laying them on the water. And what it does is it gets the flies down quicker and deeper. And, you know, I always say in my talks, the difference between the guys that catch all the fish and the guys that catch a few fish is that their flies are in the zone longer than the guys that aren't catching the fish. And this cast gets that done. You want your flies to be on the bottom through most of the drift. If you just lay your nymphs onto the surface, you have to wait for them to sink, and then they're in the zone for a short distance, and they come right back up. If you can execute the tuck cast well, you'll get the flies down quicker, and they'll spend more time on the bottom.
So when we see, if we were looking sideways at that cast as you're executing it, when you see the stop, what would we see at the terminal end there?
Well, the flies will go vertically into the water. And if you do it right, it'll actually kick your fly line up in the air. Now, this cast requires weight, and I'm assuming that we're using weight because we're nymphing. But what happens is your flies go vertically into the water as opposed to just laying on the water and then sinking.
So you almost have the fly line going parallel across the stream, and then when it stops, the flies are hanging down from the end of the fly line.
Right. They
dropping
bounce
into
back.
The water.
Exactly.
Pardon?
When you stop that rod real hard, they actually bounce back towards the angler and go directly into the water.
And is that the only trick to doing a tuck cast? I mean, can you give us
a... It really is. It's a very disciplined stop. You want to keep an open loop. You don't want to throw a tight loop. I would say, you know, the other thing that you want to do with that is you want to come over the top. It's a real hard cast to execute at three-quarter sidearm, which is how many of us cast. You really want to bring this directly over the top and stop that rod at 10:30 or 11 o'clock and let the flies do their magic.
Now, is that something, if we've got a couple of flies and weight, can we come back at three-quarters and then come forward over the top?
You can do that,
to
certainly.
To avoid tangles? Or?
Absolutely. I do that a lot. I try to keep that loop very open.
Okay. Okay. Okay, so that's the tuck cast, and so I can see the purpose of that as dropping into the current, and it's already sinking before your line ever even hits the water. So
right.
You're gaining a few seconds there of being in the zone. What's another cast you think is very important?
Another cast that's absolutely essential, especially for any dry fly fishing, is the slack leader cast. Now, this was invented by the great George Harvey. In fact, you know, one of his greatest contributions of many to our sport was his leader design, which is designed to introduce slack into the presentation. But the slack leader cast is absolutely essential for dry fly fishing. If you're looking to get a drift with a dry fly, you really need to introduce slack into the presentation. You know, a very, very common mistake that I see, especially with new anglers, is that they don't understand that the leader is not supposed to straighten out. And I hear it all the time. I see our guys say, you know, I can't get my leader to straighten out. And we say, well, that's good. You don't want it to straighten out. If it straightens out, you're not going to get a good drift. So, like the tuck cast, the slack leader cast is executed by a hard stop, and you're shocking the leader so that it sort of recoils back on itself and builds a little bit of slack in there. one of the reasons we use the Harvey Slack Leader is just for that. Even a cast that's not executed exactly properly will collapse a little bit with a Harvey Slack Leader. So it's absolutely essential to dry fly fishing.
I have to ask, what's a Harvey Slack Leader?
That is a formula that George Harvey came up with back in the 60s, and we've been using it here in central Pennsylvania ever since. I would bet that 8 out of 10 anglers that are over 30 years old that have been fishing in this area, they all use a Harvey Slack Leader. And it's actually, the formula is in my book, but it's an essential leader. In fact, I use it for everything. It's the only leader I've ever used, and I think
is it a commercially made leader, or are you?
No, we tie it ourselves. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Actually, Froghair came out with a Harvey Slack Leader, and I don't know if they still have that or not. It was an extruded leader, which was one piece.
Yeah, yeah. But to the formula, his formula, yeah. Now, when you're talking about this type of slack leader cast, what's the difference? You said it's a hard stop. What's the difference between it and a tuck cast?
It's executed on a higher plane, and the rod is just dropped. And what happens is when you come forward with your forward stroke, you have a hard stop, and then you drop the rod. And when you drop the rod tip, the current actually grabs the fly line and creates slack at the end of the fly line. And then immediately pick the rod back up so that you're in a good fishing position. But the current is used to stop the progression of the cast.
So the difference in the tuck cast, you're stopping hard up top, but you don't bring the rod down.
Right.
Correct?
That's correct.
And then with the slack leader, you stop at almost the same point, but then you're immediately dropping the rod.
Exactly. That's
and correct. Also, you're not trying to get slack in the fly line. You're trying to get slack in the leader.
Right.
Correct?
Right.
Okay.
Now, if you execute this cast at long distances, you can actually put slack into the end of the fly line, which is also advantageous. It takes a little more practice to be able to do that, but it can be done. And, you know, I think I wrote in the book, I watched Joe Humphreys do this on the Stillwater River in Montana last year. He was throwing, I'm going to guess, 60 to 70 feet of line, and he was fishing the little slack area that's in between the shore and the current on the Stillwater River. It's about a 3-foot piece of water, or 3-foot slick there, that the fish notoriously hang out and sip beetles and ants and hoppers. And we counted one time, he got 11 seconds of just absolutely still drift before the current swept his fly away. And it was absolutely amazing.
And he was doing that with the slack leader?
Yes.
Cast, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Good. Well, let's come back. We'll talk about if there's any other casts you have and line control here in just a minute. But we do have to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut, and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide fishing, and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Eric Straup about common sense fly fishing. If you'd like to ask Eric a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive the questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Eric, were there any other casts that you feel are very important for presentation purposes?
Yes, the reach cast.
Reach cast, okay.
The reach cast, and a lot of people do this. It's very simply moving the rod into a position after you come through your stroke so that the fly line drops in an advantageous place so that you can get adrift. There's a lot of times during a hatch, especially if you're in water that's not real fast or turbulent, where you're going to have fish rising all around you. And in order to get adrift to those fish, you don't want to move your position if you don't have to, because quite often we move closer to get to a fish, and that fish will move just that much further away. So you want to be able to manipulate your cast so that the fly line drops in places where you're not going to have to make a mend immediately after casting it. And the reach cast does that. It's very simply coming forward with the stroke. You know, let's say if you stop at 10 o'clock on your forward stroke, once you execute that, you've sent that fly where it's going, you've created the loop. Now it's a matter of adjusting the rod and moving the rod with your arm into a place that's going to drop the fly line in the best place.
So either left or right, basically.
Left or right, yes. Okay. Yeah, and it may buy you just another foot or two of drift, but sometimes that's all it takes.
Well, you brought up, so everyone should go out if they don't know those three casts and perfect those three casts, and it sounds like their fishing will improve immediately based upon just those casts.
I think it will. I think if an angler has a command of those three, they're going to be in a position where they should be catching fish.
Yeah, yeah. And you just brought up the fact, you know, you had mentioned mending and so forth. Let's talk about line control and mending and rod position here. When you make that cast, and if you do have to mend right away, then you've got a lot of problems, don't you?
Yes. I mean, you know, we talk about casting, and, you know, a really good cast is not necessarily one that's 90 feet. It's more one that's 30 or 40 feet, but it drops the fly line in the right place. So we want to try to eliminate as much mending as we can, you know, both by our position and our cast. You know, mending, I think we tend to overdo that sometimes. We should set up our cast, our presentation a little better, rather than try to react to the current that the river's showing us.
I almost get this picture of, you know, you're looking at the stream, you see a good lie, you think there's a fish, or you see a fish in there. And the best possible position you could be in would be downstream and high stick it with no line in the water.
Right.
Would be position number one, ideal.
Exactly.
And then you work your way back from that into secondary and positions that are maybe less advantageous but solve a couple of the problems, and you do
exactly.
Some of those problems with the casting. And your last resort really is this line mending situation when you have no other choice. But that really cuts down on your being in the zone, doesn't it? I mean, when you're lending that line, you're potentially, you know, jerking that fly around. And
exactly. And what most often happens is that we pull all the slack out of our leader, you know, when we mend. You know, if we're fishing a dry fly, if you're fishing a nymph and you have to mend, you know, there's a good chance you're not in the right position. So, you know, like you said, you hit the nail on the head. If we have to mend our presentation, we might be able to improve our position.
Right, right.
And, yep. You know, that should be a last resort.
Yeah, yeah. That makes a lot of sense, a lot of common sense. We were talking earlier, and I said, well, there's a lot of things that seem pretty obvious in your book that weren't so obvious until I read them. And what was your response?
Sometimes common sense is not so common.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when you're out on the water. That's when you seem to forget many things.
Absolutely. Yeah, rising fish will do that to you.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about, we've got several questions about, well, equipment, rigging, flies, all kinds of things here. So we got lots of things to cover here. Justin in Des Moines, Iowa says, gear, how much is too much? What is a list of essential items? What is nice to have but not necessary? What is just overkill and has no place on the water? So I think he's trying to get, you know, maybe minimalistic here, so to speak, on what really do I need?
Well, you know, well, I used to own a fly shop, and I would say that you should have as much gear as you possibly can on a dry stick.
bring a trailer with you on an
exactly.
extra boat.
Support your local fly shop. they need it. I don't know. That's an interesting question. You know, part of the fun of this game is all the gadgets and gear. I really believe that. I have a lot of clients that collect rods and reels, and that's really part of it. So I would say, you know, if you have so much gear that you can't execute a reach cast, then you probably have too much. Or if you sink, if you fall. You know, that might be too much gear. But, you know, take what you're comfortable with, and, you know, it's always good to have stuff. You know, our guides and myself, we carry probably 10 times the flies that we really need, but you just feel more comfortable when you have them.
Yeah.
So it's just fishing, and it's fun, and gear is fun, too. So there's nothing you don't need.
Rim Chung, who's a designer of the RS-2 fly.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to him, and I think he told me, I could be wrong here, but I think he fishes with, like, 3 flies.
Yeah.
RS-2 is one of them, and then he's got a couple of other flies that he created, and that's all he fishes with. And generally, you go fishing with him, and he'll outfish every time he takes you out. And so it kind of comes down to, I think, more presentation and getting that fly, getting that right drift, than it does having a whole box of flies sometimes. But
absolutely. You know, I just finished an article on simplifying your fly selection, and I went through what I really fish with, and it's very few flies. But yet I still carry all the patterns with me. But you're right. It's more presentation and depth and, you know, being in the right place than it is anything else.
We got a question from Al in British Columbia, and he asked, do you have any advice for ghost lines, those clear lines? Do you have any take on that?
No, I never didn't even know they existed. I'm sort of sheltered here in central Pennsylvania.
Okay.
I've always, you know, I know guys that go down to, that go to New Zealand and, you know, they say you have to have a white line and everything else. You know, all fly lines make a dark silhouette on the surface. You know, if you put it over a fish, the fact that it's falling on the fish is what spooks them. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know that it makes that much difference.
Okay.
I do know that when people can't see their fly line and what they're casting, sometimes that's a hindrance to good casting. So, you know, I see some guys that buy the olive or the brown lines.
Or camo or whatever.
Yeah, and sometimes it's a lot easier to cast a line that you can see because if you are throwing a tailing loop, you can actually see what you're doing.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that stuff makes a difference. You know,
okay.
We've all been catching trout for years and years with bright yellow lines.
Okay. Mike in Boise, Idaho asks, I only fish one fly at a time, but many of the people I fish with fish an indicator and a dropper. Am I missing out by fishing only one fly?
I would say yes. There's nothing wrong with imitating a couple different stages of patterns, especially if you're prospecting. In central PA and Pennsylvania, we're allowed to fish 3 flies, and it's very rare that we don't have 3 patterns on.
Wow.
And, you know, I think it has a couple of advantages. One, it's the suggestion of food. If you're nymphing, you know, suggesting some different food items can sometimes trigger a take. You can also hit a couple of different stages. I most often fish a soft tackle with 2 nymphs below it. So, you know, if they are starting to emerge a little bit, that might be the trigger that gets them. You know, and certainly a dry and a dropper is a great way to go, especially during the hatches.
Yeah, how many times have you had your indicator strike on your indicator, right?
Absolutely.
And wish it was a hopper at that moment.
Exactly.
With a hook in it, yeah. We have Joe in Marcy, New York, asks, what is an easy way to tell how long your leader needs to be between your indicator and your fly?
There's sort of an unwritten rule that works pretty well, that your indicator should be 1.5 times the depth of the water you're fishing. And what that does is it allows for a little bit of slack in between your nymphs and the indicator, but not too much. And it allows for the indicator, you know, generally the surface speed of the current will be a little faster than the bottom speed. And it allows for a good angle there, and any time those nymphs stop, you should be able to see it with your indicator. If your indicator is set too high up on your leader, you'll just catch on the bottom and you won't see much. And if it's, obviously, if it's too close to your nymphs, you're not going to get the depth you're looking for. So I would say, you know, that's a good rule, 1.5 times the depth of the water.
Okay. We got Martin in Lawrence, Kansas, and he said he enjoyed watching you and the guys on Riseform TV. So he must have seen you doing something here. He asked, can you discuss the setup of the indicator slack leader setup and fishing with weight close to your flies? How weighted are your flies when you fish this system, and how much weight do you put on your tippet? So do you want to talk about how you weight flies and lines?
Sure. The indicator that he's talking about is a piece of yellow monofilament that I tie into my leader.
Oh, okay.
And we do a lot of tight line nymphing, or some folks call it high sticking, and we stick the weight in between the flies. I typically like to have a soft tackle that's 18 inches or so above my first nymph on a dropper. It sticks off of the leader about 4 or 5 inches. My middle fly would be my heavy fly, I typically tie that. It's a weighted pattern, and I like to fish something that's fairly large, maybe a size 10 or 12 weighted fly. And then I like to hang a small nymph off of the bend of that that'll just drift along the bottom. Now, I put my weight, my split shot, in between the soft tackle and the heavy nymph, so the whole rig gets down. And that rig works for me. And, you know, you go with 10 different guides, they'll probably rig their rods up 10 different ways. Like I said earlier, there's 1,000 ways to skin a cat. That rig works for me, and I've had a lot of success with it.
How do you keep that weight from moving? Are you using split shot there? Or?
I'm using lead split shot, yes.
You put a knot in the leader or anything?
I don't. Okay. I don't. I just crimp it on the leader. You know, if you use fluorocarbon, the split shot will slide on you, but I don't use fluorocarbon, never have, and okay. It works fine.
Okay. Randy in Denver asks, do you have any secrets that allow quick switches between nymph and dry rigs to react to what is encountered on the stream?
No.
That's a common problem.
No, I don't.
Take practice a boat with two rods, right?
Yeah. Take two rods, practice your knots.
Yeah.
No, I will say I use the same leader. I use the Harvey Slack leader for everything I do. I just change the terminal end.
Okay. And you got Tony asking about, do you ever use two flies? You already addressed that.
Yes.
You use three flies.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, if you use two, shorten yourself.
Yeah. We need to take another quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk about flies and some of your favorites here and see what we can pick out of you there. So hang
very
tight
good
here, Eric.
You got it.
Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish, big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as the seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at www.flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Eric Straup about common sense fly fishing. If you'd like to ask Eric a question, just go to our homepage at AskAboutFlyFishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Let's see here. We've got a couple questions that came in here. Let me grab some of these, Eric, and see if
sure
we can address these. We got Rick in Maple Glen, Pennsylvania. He says, is there any type of fly or style of fly fishing you do not or will not use? Interesting question.
No. No, I like fishing. I'd try anything once.
As long as it falls in the area of fly fishing and not
snagging, exactly, yeah,
or chumming or that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. So you're always open to new ideas, always something new to learn, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. We have John in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, one of your local friends there. Why is Penns Creek in Center County, Pennsylvania, such a difficult stream to fish more often than not? Are you familiar with Penns Creek?
Very much so.
Okay. I don't think it's pressure because I fish a lot of other streams up there, Spring Creek, for example, that get pounded, but they're still a lot easier to fish. Is it because there is such a wide variety of food available to the fish? What gives on that stream?
That's a great question, and glad to answer it. First, I'll start the answer off with that's my favorite stream on planet Earth.
Oh, wow.
And I will tell you that any time I start my guide day on Penns Creek, I tell my clients, you may not catch a fish today. And that's just the way Penns Creek is. First of all, the trout are literally at the top of the gene pool. They survive incredible temperature changes. Penns Creek tends to get warm, so the fish that survive there are extremely hardy. The other thing that makes Penns tough is, like he said, there is a lot of food, and those fish eat all the time. Penns is a deep stream with big boulders. It's very hard to nymph. You have to use the tuck cast. because it's the only way to get your flies down quick enough to get in between the boulders. If you don't lose a lot of flies on Penn's Creek when you're nymphing, you're not deep enough. It's just a very difficult stream. I guided it the other day, and we caught two fish all day long, and once the spinnerfall hit at night, and it was literally right at dark, I got back to my vehicle at 9:30. We caught lots of fish then, but we didn't do much during the day. So the fish are there. He hit the nail on the head. It's a tough stream to fish, and it's tough to figure out.
Well, you just gave him a couple of good tips, though, I think. So
yeah, you've got to be deep, and always remember, you know, at any given time, there could be two or three different insects that they'll be feeding on, and by the time you figure it out, they'll switch.
Yeah.
So it's a classic. I love the stream. I tell everybody it's the Rose Bowl of fly fishing. When you think you're good at this game, go spend a week on Penn's and get humbled.
We got Carrie in Springfield ask, what is the best way for someone interested in becoming a guide to get started?
It's a good question. I would say, contact your local fly shop, see if they do trips, call a guide service, go out and shadow with one of their guides for a while and see if it's something that you'd like to do. You know, it's not fishing. It's different
right.
than fishing.
You don't do any fishing.
Exactly. It's virtual fishing. You're fishing
yeah.
through somebody else, and every day is different. And, I'll say it, I think it's an honorable profession. You know, we treat it as a profession. We're very proud of the fact that we work hard to be professional and learn how to teach and learn how to verbalize things. And it's great. You know, you can make one of the best days of the year for a person. So call somebody that's doing it and talk to them about doing it in your local area.
Shadowing them and maybe being an apprentice or something.
Exactly, yep.
Yeah, I know we did a show with Landon Mayer on sight fishing, and we were talking about this. And, you know, when you're guiding, it's a totally different perspective, and you have the chance to see more fish, to study more what's going on than when you're fishing. I mean,
yes.
Like you say, when you're fishing, you're so damn excited sometimes, you forget everything. And,
right, you won't believe what you see when you're not actually fishing.
Right, and so I think that's a good exercise for anyone to maybe go spend a day on the stream with your buddy and never put your line in the water.
Exactly.
Just play like you're a guide and see what you can learn.
Absolutely.
I think that would be a great exercise, yeah. We got a question from Ben in Glendora, California. How do you set up a rig to fish emergers at different stages? So you got some pointers on that?
Yeah, emergers are tough. You know, a lot depends on the particular hatch that you're fishing. If you're fishing a caddis hatch, I like to fish those emergers deep, you know, with the La Fontaine sparkle pupa, the deep sparkle pupa. Fishing soft tackles deep works well. You know, at other times, you really have to use your powers of observation because you have to identify where the trout are feeding so that you know where to fish that. Most often, I fish emergers off of a dry fly. So, you know, I'm using the dry fly as an indicator. And, you know, fishing something that's hanging off of it, maybe 3 inches in the film, maybe I'm fishing something that's weighted a little bit so that it gets down a little bit deeper. But, there is no constant rig for emergers. You really have to know where they're feeding and set your rig appropriately for that.
Keep experimenting, I guess. Huh?
Absolutely.
Switching up, yeah, until you get it right. Another question, Dale from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania asks, what is your take on the longer switch rods for spring creeks? Would their extended reach be helpful for nymphing?
Absolutely. I've not used the switch rods, but I can tell you I use a 10-foot rod for my nymphing. And one of the biggest detriments to some of the people that we guide is that they come with short rods. You know, so we always carry rods with us when we're guiding that are 9 and 10 feet long, just because, you know, anytime you can add your reach by a foot or two, it's going to make a tremendous difference. So I would say absolutely, if you can increase your reach with a switch rod, by all means, give it a shot.
Yeah, okay. We got a question from Daniel in Lake Havasu about whether to fish upstream or downstream. And Daniel, listen to the first part of the show. Eric addressed that very specifically. So if you missed that, re-listen to the recording and you'll get that answer that you're looking for there. We've got some other, okay, that's quite a few we took online here. We've still got some others that came in advance. A couple of questions here all around what are your favorite flies. Marquis in Colorado Springs and David in Michigan are asking, you know, what are your favorite couple dries, couple nymphs, and couple streamers that you wouldn't go without?
Well, certainly, I mean, nobody should ever be without a woolly bugger, black and olive. You know, anybody that doesn't have those patterns shouldn't be on a trout stream.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm very simplistic with my patterns for the most part. You know, hare's ears, pheasant tails, caddis larvae of all different colors. The Adams you should never be without. A standard elk hair caddis, you know, with brown and green colors, even black. Those things, you know, everybody should have those with them at any given time. And, of course, rusty spinners. You never want to be without those standard patterns because they work all the time. They've been catching trout for hundreds of years, and they'll be catching them 100 years from now, God willing.
Isn't it amazing how oft the Adams and the hare's ear come up in
Absolutely.
That list of favorite flies? I tell you, I've caught more fish on those two flies than anything else, I think.
Absolutely, and, you know, very simple soft tackles.
Yeah.
You know, I get questions all the time about emergers. What type of emergers do you fish? And I really don't fish anything very extravagant. I fish soft tackles, and we tie soft tackles to match every hatch that we have.
Mm.
So, you know, if you've got a sulfur hatch and the sulfurs are yellow in color, you tie a yellow soft tackle and fish it in the film, and they work.
Casey in Arlington, Virginia, has an interesting question about flies. He says, do stocked trout eat anything different from wild trout? Would different flies be more effective for tournaments and so forth on heavily stocked water than for the wild?
Casey in Arlington is a female, Roger, and she is a great woman fly fisherman.
Oh, yeah, you know Casey, huh?
I do. And, yes, I would say, you know, stock trout do act a little differently than wild fish. First of all, they're conditioned to feed on top. When they're in hatcheries, they're fed on the surface with pellets. And so there's quite often times when, you know, if they just stock a stream, you can go with a dry fly of almost any sort and get a rise out of a trout. And I don't think they're quite as conditioned to the natural feed that's in a stream. It takes them a while to get to that point. So I think the biggest difference is if they're freshly stocked. You know,
okay.
They're going to act a little differently than wild fish. But, it doesn't take them all that long to get with the program.
Yeah, it's either that or be on the hook. Right?
Exactly.
get smart or goodbye.
Exactly.
Steve, and he's up in the Adirondacks, northern New York, asks, how often do you toss aside hatch-matching efforts and use patterns such as those created by your good friend Charlie Meck, like the Patriot, Green Weenie, and even the Blueberry? Is presentation more critical than pattern?
I would say presentation is more critical than pattern, but it's rare that I get away from the standard stuff that I use. You know, if I'm not catching fish with that stuff, I generally try to search different water types until I start catching fish. But, you know, I'm not opposed to throwing a green weenie or a San Juan either. You know, and when I'm guiding, a lot of times, you know, if you have a client that's struggling in certain water types or say that they can't get into certain water types for one reason or another, and you're limited to one place, that's when I really start switching patterns up. You know, if I have somebody that's, say, not very mobile, and I can't move very far, and I've showed the fish everything in my box, and I'm going to stay there, then I'll start switching stuff, and I'll see if I can find a trigger. Sometimes it's chartreuse. Sometimes it's pink. You know, a pink San Juan catches fish anywhere. You know, so does a green weenie. It's funny. I was on the Madison one time with a guide. I was fishing with a guide, and I said, I just want to see if a green weenie will work here in Montana, and sure enough, we caught fish on it. So, yeah, those patterns work.
Yeah. Chris in Farmington, Utah asks, how long do you try out a fly without catching fish before you change and try something different? So based upon what you just said, you know, how long do you give a spot before you're switching up?
You know, I'm of the belief that I should have a pretty good idea of what's in the water and what's available to trout, just because I get to spend 100 and so many days on the water. So if I'm not catching fish with a pattern, it's because I'm not fishing it right or I'm not at the right depth. So I don't switch the patterns all that often. If I have to almost have a reason to switch the pattern. You know, and certainly during a hatch, you switch patterns a lot because you may get a refusal or the hatch may change. You know, something may change in the hatch. Mm-hmm. They may change what they're feeding on. But, you know, if you're just prospecting and you're fishing with a hare's ear and a pheasant tail and or a caddis larva, and you know that that stuff is a good representation of what's in the water, change how you're fishing it, not necessarily your pattern.
Okay. Okay. By the way, we have Rob Straup with an E from Atlanta. Is he a relative? Or?
No, he's not, but he's a friend. I know Rob. Yep.
He says, Eric, Frog Hair still sells George Harvey leaders.
So
for folks out there looking for those in a manufactured form, I guess they're available. So.
Absolutely. Great.
Thanks, Rob, for letting us know about that. Your last comment brings up this other question from Kent in Peoria, Arizona. What is a good resource for finding out hatch times for different insects in a stream or lake once the species are known or identified? Also, will a particular species hatch at the same time in California as it will in Idaho or other times of year? So you know your Pennsylvania streams, so
right.
You don't really need to go consulting anybody. But let's say you are going to someplace new. What's the best way to find out about the hatches and when they occur?
Oh, boy, fly shops, certainly the Internet. You know, there's forums all over the place now. You can find out, you know, what's going on just about anywhere in the world. You know, we're really lucky. The guys who did all this stuff 50 years ago, they were the real innovators. We've got every bit of information right at our fingertips now. So I would say, you know, call the local fly shops to where you're going or look on the Internet.
Okay, okay. David in Grand Rapids, Michigan says, my question is quite a simple one. I often find the selection of a fly overwhelming. What can you suggest to make it more simplified process of thought that he can use in this situation? So I guess he's looking in that box of 100 flies trying to figure out which one to pick.
Right. Keep it really simple. You know, you can never go wrong with hare's ears, pheasant tails, and caddis larvae when you're fishing underneath. You know, in 90% of all trout streams, caddis larvae are the most predominant species. So, you know, they're easy to tie. Anybody can tie them. It's just fur on a hook pretty much. Stay with the natural colors, you know, browns, greens, olives, and black. You're always going to be in the game with those patterns, you know. And if you get into a situation where you don't think you're going to have any success, try putting on a green weenie or something a little more flashy and see what that does for you. But, you know, you can never go wrong with the old standards. They've worked for a long, long time. They still work. And, you know, we tend to make this a lot more complicated than it is.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I always remind people, you know, you can catch trout with corn on a hook. I mean, that happens. And so remember that. And just remember that, you know, natural colors, an array of sizes will always catch fish, and just fish them right. Take your time, fish the likely places where trout should be, and don't be so concerned with your pattern as you are how you fish it.
Well, that's a good note to end the show on. We are out of time, Eric, and it goes by fast, doesn't it?
It does. I'm surprised it's over already.
But we have run out of time, and we didn't get to all the questions, but we did our best, folks. Thanks for sending in your questions and submitting them, and I'm sure Eric did give us a lot of good tips tonight, so we really appreciate that. Well, we got to wrap things up, but stick with us here, and we're going to be giving a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and a copy of Eric's book, courtesy of Headwaters Books, Common Sense Fly Fishing. So stick with us and see if you win one of those prizes. A mining company called Pack Grim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chuitna Coal Project will be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat. The Chuitna River drainage, 11 miles of it, and this is critical commercial to the commercial sport and subsistence fishing economies, which would be permanently destroyed. Pack Rim says it can rebuild the salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chuitna Coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chuitna Coal Strip Mine. For more information on how you can help, visit www.inletkeeper.org, inletkeeper.org, or www.trustees.org, trustees.org. If Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave us your comments. Now it's time to give away our prizes. And the winners for the first two prizes are randomly drawn from our registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for the next show because we're always giving away these great prizes and we want you to win. So if you are one of the lucky winners, after the show we'll get in contact with you and provide you with the information we need to get you your prize. So first of all, we are going to give away that one-year subscription to, or membership to, the Federation of Fly Fishers. Now, the Federation of Fly Fishers is a great organization to support, and if you aren't a member, become one. You can find out more about them on fedflyfishers.org, www.fedflyfishers.org. So our winner of that one-year membership, and you already have this, we'll extend it for you, is Warren Davis in Ohio. Warren Davis, so congratulations. And next gift or giveaway is the one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and that is a great magazine that all of you should be getting. If you want to find out more about that, it's at flyfusionmag.com, www.flyfusionmag.com. Great magazine on how-tos and wonderful photography. I always enjoy it. And this, our winner, is Marquis in Colorado. I think it was Colorado Springs. He had asked a question earlier, so congratulations, Marquis. And thanks for sticking with us and winning that prize. Well, now we need to, Eric, come up with a question that we can ask folks, and people online have a chance to win your book. And so I got to clear my queue here just a minute, so that we have a clear cue and I can take in the question on tonight's show. What, we talked about this at the beginning of the show, what is the most important thing that Eric felt you needed to obtain to catch fish? What's the most important thing that you needed to do to catch more fish? And this is the a good thing to do right at the beginning of the show. We were talking about this. Okay, looks like we have, and tell me if this answer is correct, the drift. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That's correct. Always want to get that good drift. And we've got a winner, Jim in Atlanta, Georgia. Jim in Atlanta, Georgia. So, hey, Jim, thanks for listening and paying attention. And what you want to do, Jim, is send me your contact information, first, last name, address, email address, and so forth. You can do that in the box you just answered in, or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com, and we'll get Headwater Books to send you out a copy of Common Sense Fly Fishing. And thanks, Eric, for writing that book, and thanks to Headwaters for making it available tonight for the folks.
Thank you, Roger.
And Eric, it was a pleasure to talk to you. I know we had much more to cover, and as we always do on these shows, but we got to give up some time. And, all the more reason to buy your book and learn everything you have to teach there. And there's much more that we just didn't even break the surface of. So folks, go out and get Eric's book and support him and learn a lot more about fly fishing. Well, Eric, thanks for being with us tonight. It was a pleasure, and I sure enjoyed it, and I hope the folks did too. And thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Roger. I really appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk about fishing. It doesn't get any better than that.
It's always fun, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Well, our next broadcast will be on May 5th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern, and on that show we'll interview Rich Murphy, and our topic for the show will be fly fishing for striped bass. Rich Murphy has been fly fishing for striped bass for more than 25 years and knows the northeast coast of the U.S. like his backyard. So find out all of Rich's secrets on catching and landing these exciting saltwater trophies on our next show. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Royal Gorge Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters, and Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.